Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, when will the legislature wrap up its budget work for the year? Former Rep. Adam Zemke of the consulting firm 1837 adds his perspective to this, aggregate mining and the Democratic majority's first 6 months. Rep. Carrie Reingans is making national popular vote her number one priority, but she has many other sticks in the fire. And the leadership at the Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences explains how they're able to pay qualified teachers $100,000 a year. Now, here's MERS editor Kyle Malin with Danielle James.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore, and happy Juneteenth to everybody listening today. And joining us here live in studio, a friend of the podcast, former Democratic representative, and now managing partner for the consulting firm 1837, Adam Zemke. Thanks for joining us here.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Danielle.
We wanted to first get an update, Danielle, on the budget as we approach the final 2 weeks of June. And I know there's going to be a mad dash to try and get the budget done before the July 4th holiday. What do you know on that front?
It's still a little shaky, but I don't know if it's going to happen. I've been told that, you know, people don't know yet if conference committees will meet next week. It's possible, but there's not expecting budget votes before the week of the 26th. And that's on the House side. On the Senate side, there's not really any official updates. I've been told that, you know, Senator Anthony and Majority Leader Brinks are less concerned about the time it will take and more concerned about getting it right.
So we don't really know if they're going to get done by July 4th. There's a hope, but we don't know for sure.
Yes, the hope is still the last week in June, but it could be later in July.
Adam, give us a little bit about your background here with the state representatives. When did you serve?
So I served from January of 2013 through the end of 2018. And as it pertains to the budget, I did sit on the Appropriations Committee for two of those terms.
So as we're looking at this Democratic majority trying to put together its first budget here with a lot of money, does any of this news surprise you that it doesn't seem like the schedule is pretty hard and fast at this point?
Well, you know, Kyle, to be honest with you, I don't think there's ever been a legislature, regardless of who's in the majority, who has, you know, set a firm deadline, and it's been clockwork with every step, right? We see a deadline that they, I think, are trying to get to at the end of this month. I personally think that they will get there. They've been very aggressive with everything they've done the last 6 months. The chairs, Senator Anthony, I served with, and Chair Whitwer, my wife, was college roommates with her daughter.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes.
Wow, fun fact.
Know each other very well. And, you know, I they are strong leaders, and we have Speaker Tate and Senate Majority Leader Brinks as well. I think they're going to hit this. I don't think that what we're seeing right now, it's abnormal from any time that we've seen in the past. I think they're going to hit whatever deadline they're marching towards. And based on everything we've seen the last 6 months, I mean, frankly, being on the outside and talking with clients about what's happening in the legislature, it feels like we've been drinking out of a fire hose, the amount of public policy that these folks have put forth and passed. So I feel confident that they will hit their deadlines on the budget as well.
I think it's worth pointing out that this budget cycle is a lot different from the last two that we had, where it seemed like there were a couple key principals, Senator Jim Stamos and Curtis Sertel and a couple others got in the room and kind of hammered out all the details and all the budget that kind of laid it out and said, here, this is what we're going to all pass. And everybody had gotten a bit of something. So there was a lot of yes votes. This is going to be a lot different in that the focus is now shifted to the subcommittee level. And these subcommittee chairs are going line by line by line on these different budgets. And Adam, there's just so many items of difference on a lot of these budgets.
You know, the bottom line is that these are all big budgets. I mean, this budget is bigger than what I was accustomed to working on. I think we heard that from several representatives earlier last term. And the reality is that points of difference, we would expect them to increase as a result of that. There's more line items in the budget, more things going on. And frankly, they're solving some pretty big problems that have been neglected for a while as well. So I think it was Senator Brinks that said, was quoted maybe in your publication recently that said, you know, we're going to be working some late nights and weekends in order to get things done. And I think that is an accurate statement. And frankly, that jives with past experience, regardless of who's been in power.
You know, what does it look like behind the scenes at this point? How do they begin to kind of go through and resolve these differences, get these budgets passed?
Well, I wish I could tell you what exactly it looks like from behind the scenes, but I'm not in the legislature. I think that all budgets, just like every piece of public policy that you have to negotiate for votes on, is an effort of compromise. You know, and we started out with, at the start of this process, with three budgets that, regardless of individual items that, you know, somebody may have that they like in one of the budgets or one of the others, all of them were excellent starting points. Let's just start with that sort of level setting tone. So the fact that, you know, we're getting down to the last few items that are of points of difference, regardless of how many or few that are, it's always the toughest things, right? When you're getting down to the end and you have fewer things to negotiate on, you have fewer things to use as leverage for other things that people want. And ultimately, they've set targets. I don't know what those targets are. That's not abnormal either, but they have set targets, and so they've made decisions about how much they're going to spend. Now they have to figure out how they're going to make the math work. That feels just as normal as it's ever been. And frankly, I think that they'll get there. They've been pretty successful the last 6 months.
The Republicans have grumbled that they have not been part of the negotiations up to this point. But in the Senate in particular, they're going to need six Republicans in order to get immediate effect, get this budget rolling. At what point do you envision the Republicans being brought in and being asked, okay, what do you want? What is it going to take to get these six immediate effect votes?
So, you know, I've heard these comments from Senator Nesbitt, and I've served with him as well. From what I understand, at least, there has been continued conversations amongst the leadership, which is the traditional route when you have majority-minority control. When I served in the minority for all three terms, and it is not nearly as fun, I'm sure, as serving in the majority. But I was able to have success with several programs, creation of several programs that are ongoing within the state budget, because I built those relationships and I sat on the subcommittees that dealt with them. I think maybe what we could be hearing about is getting used to the reshuffling of the chairs, where you have had all Republican control for the last 40 years and now they are in the minority. And I'm sure that is tough to deal with, frankly. As a member who has been used to being in the majority, now being in the minority. And so it does take some adjusting to get to, I imagine. Being on the flip side of it, you know, it wasn't nearly as fun being in the minority as I'm sure the folks are having now. And so, you know, I don't think that, from what I understand, there are conversations going on between both sides. And I think that is legitimate. Is it as much as somebody wants? Probably not. But that's just because of the difference in power.
I know the party's changed a little bit since your time, you know, directly in the legislature. But I'm curious, what do you think are some things that that Democrats won't compromise on?
I don't think they will compromise on any of their core values, for sure. I think that you've seen, based on the public policy that has been put forth and is being debated, either through the committee process or having been introduced, that Democrats are going to stand with the creation of, as it pertains to the budget, a fiscally responsible budget. They're going to be smart about it, but they're going to look to solve transformational problems. If we look at investments in public health, in the environment, in education, you can see not only changes in spending to the positive, but you can also see policy priorities that are apparent in the boilerplate. And so I think they're going to stick with their core values. I don't think they're going to compromise on any of those. But there are also nuances within each of those programs, too. And each of those nuances typically has a price tag.
Aggregates. This has been a dividing line in the Democratic caucus. There's been a couple of them this term. This is one of them. We've got the environmental side, who are very hesitant about expanding the mining of sand and gravel for roads. And on the other side, you have organized labor, which is very anxious to get more road building going on, more jobs. And the argument is you build more mines and the sand and the gravel is closer to the construction site, saves more money, more roads are going to be able to be fixed. Kind of walk us through how that dividing line works, because that is not uncommon with this with Democratic caucuses, particularly with the House.
Well, I would say that this issue has been around a long time. It was around when I was a member of the legislature. I think pretty early on, it probably was around times that predated me, in fact. You know, I think that it's probably come surfaced a lot more recently because the governor has campaigned and she was first elected in part based on her aggressive plans to fix the roads and the investments that have been made by the state to do so. It makes sense that this issue is coming up again. And frankly, solving some of these transformational problems like infrastructure rebuilding is important. And, you know, regardless of one's stance on this particular issue, the people who have taken it on should be applauded for taking it on, because it is a step that should be discussed and debated by the legislature in an effort to get to that point where we actually have infrastructure that is up to par. You know, I give a lot of compliments to the legislators who have taken it on and are going to take it on. Now, that said, I think that we are seeing, as we've seen and you reported on some last week, healthy debate, which is what should happen. Because I think that there are concerns that are being brought up by both sides of this issue, the environmental community and those who are champions of public health, I think have legitimate concerns with the ability for local governments and sort of NIMBYism to take over in a lot of ways. You know, a friend of mine who often criticized NIMBYism is now calls himself a NIMBY on certain things. And it's just because, you know, it's because it is your local community and it becomes very personal. And so I get that as well. And so I think, you know, Representative Carter in particular had some comments last week that they are working to try and really create some checks and balances and solve that. Will they get to a spot where everybody's happy? I have absolutely no idea. But the bottom line is that it seems like they're going to make progress around creating something that will support the transformational elements and hopefully address the public health and environmental concerns that I think are also legit.
So you believe that there can be compromise on something that would seem on its face to be pretty divisive?
I think it really depends on who's in the room. You know, politics and policy are all about the people. Who are there and who is negotiating and what are their values? And so I am always hopeful. I have to be optimistic around this place because sometimes things don't move as quickly as you'd like. And but I think that we've got a good group of folks. You know, this issue in particular is debated on a bipartisan basis. And I think with a good group of folks who are from both parties, from all over the state, willing to have discussions, I think that you have the best opportunity for compromise to happen. Will it actually get there? I don't think anybody knows the answer to that.
As a former freshman representative yourself, you come in with high hopes. And when you're in the majority, you have a perception that I'm going to get a lot of things done. We're going to tick right through. But I think that there may have been some heartburn at the beginning to see all this money go toward corporations, go toward Goshen, try and help the sawmill up north, go to Ford for that Marshall plant. And there may be some heartburn from people thinking, oh my gosh, when are we going to get to our priorities? What would you say to those freshman representatives, which half of the House is right now, about their experience so far so they don't feel completely downcast, that they're not seeing their democratic values that they ran on implemented here in the first 6 months?
You're asking me to remember what it was like to be a freshman legislator.
Well, that long ago, you're a young guy. You still got a fresh brain.
I will take that compliment and you buttering me up. I appreciate that. As a freshman, I came in and I was in the minority. All three levels of government, you know, the House, the Senate, and the governorship, you know, in that legislative policymaking process at least, were all controlled by the Republicans. I kept my eyes wide open and worked on things that I thought could move and that would be transformational. And those are the things that ultimately became areas where I had some success and areas where I didn't have success. Nothing happened fast. And nothing will happen fast now, I don't think. I think that the policymaking process is messy. And frankly, I think the general public doesn't really understand what the sausage being made really looks like and maybe gets frustrated with it. But I do think it will happen. Further, I will say that after, you know, it's now mid-June, legislature has been here, I think, exactly 6 months with the Democratic trifecta. Think about the large priorities, the sort of transformational, from the Democratic perspective, priorities that have gotten done in the last 6 months. It's been like drinking out of a fire hose, watching from the outside in, if you understand the process. So even though some things have not moved as fast, it has not been because they've been sitting on their hands or couldn't get agreement. It's because the sheer number of large transformational democratic priorities that have gotten done have taken a lot of time. And 6 months is really not that long to do everything that they have had. So I would say, as a recommendation to any freshman, regardless of party, work with colleagues on both sides of the aisle, always gain support, build friendships so that you see one another as people, not partisan opposition members, and keep working towards it. I can tell you one priority that I worked on for 2.5 terms was an item that is created in the budget to create a state program around STEM education. And it took us a long time. There was local component elements that were messy. There were state component elements that were messy. And as a result of that, plus I was in the minority, but we built relationships with then Representative Kelly and Senator Hansen, and we got it done eventually. I think that was a tremendous success. And the reality is that others will also have success this term. It just may not happen overnight.
You know, what does it look like going forward for some of these freshmen who are already right out the gate willing to stand up for what they believe in and say they won't support the budget?
I read about this a little bit last week. I've not actually heard anybody say that they will not support the budget or are holding their vote out from the budget on, you know, because they don't want to see something else happen or anything like that. I've not heard that yet. So until I hear it directly from somebody, I don't. And I have a lot of friendships with a lot of legislators. I knew some of them before they got here, and I served with some of them, and a lot of them, actually. And so I've not heard anybody say that. So, and I do think that ultimately they will arrive at a spot on the budget. I don't foresee a world where, and obviously nobody can foreshadow anything, but I would be very surprised if they can't get to a good spot on the budget. And I think they'll get bipartisan support too. And, you know, I think even Senator Nesbitt has hinted to that effect. So I think they'll get there.
56 votes is all they need to pass something, pass a budget. And they've gotten those 56 votes. Have you been impressed by the caucus and how they've held together?
Yeah, of course. The issues that they have taken on are critically important, in my perspective, for the transformation of the state. They support everyday people. They improve working conditions. They provide for support for improving public education. And they're not small things. And they have gotten those 56. I think they should be applauded for everything they've done for the last 6 months. And I think they're going to continue to make the rest of us drink out of a fire hose for the next year and a half, too. And frankly, that's a really good thing.
You got to miss this, don't you?
I have to say, I've gotten this question a lot, actually. It would be wonderful to be to serve in the majority. But I also sort of have a belief that each of us were here at a particular time for a particular reason. And I think I played a role in shaping some of the public policy when I was here for that reason. And so, and plus, you know, I get to still have fun with a lot of the policymaking process, and I really enjoy what I do. And so, is the grass always greener on the other side? Maybe at some times, but at other times, it's also frustrating.
No, I can believe it. Well, like I said before, you still got a lot of years left, so never say never.
I will never say never on anything.
There you go.
Thank you.
Adam Zemke, former Democratic State Representative, now Managing Partner for the consulting firm 1837. Appreciate you coming by.
Thank you so much, Kyle. Thank you, Danielle.
You know me. One thing I can tell you is you got to be free. Come together.
Joining us now in MERS World Headquarters with Samantha Schreiber and Danielle James is the prolific Representative Kerry Reingans. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Anytime I see a bill now in the legislature that's the least bit controversial or on topic and like going on right now, why is your name always attached to it?
Well, I am here as a policymaker. I'm a little bit of a policy nerd, and I've been working in the field of health disparities and really trying to find ways to help make sure that folks in Michigan are as happy and healthy as they can be. So all of these policy things that I'm working on right now, to me, directly relate to the health of Michiganders.
I mean, Democrats this year, I mean, this is really the party of 40 years of pent-up policy. How do leaders do when it comes to, you know, someone coming forward with so many ideas and trying to give them a realistic chance to get voted out?
That's a really great question. As you know, I have only been here 6 months. And as much as I'm new to the legislature, all of us are new to being a majority. And so we have dozens and dozens of really great policy ideas. And we started with the big six, right? We were very excited, obviously had clear agreement that we want to repeal right to work, restore prevailing wage, make sure that we restore the working families tax credit, make sure that we repeal that retirement tax on seniors in Michigan, and expand Elliott Larson to include LGBT protections after 50 years of trying. And then also make sure that we are repealing old statutes. The first one that we all agreed on, obviously, was the 1931 abortion ban. But there's so much more, right? There's just this week we voted to repeal some old things in the Healthy Michigan Plan, which is Michigan's Medicaid health plan for the expansion population. And there's things in there that were really only needed to get it passed at the time and aren't even necessary anymore. Some report in 2015 or something. Like, so we're trying to clean up old stuff while we have the chance, but also push forward things that really protect Michiganders. We really want to make sure that we're advancing things for working people. We're advancing things to protect the public's health. And as far as leaders go, I can't speak for our leadership because I'm not in it. I am a deputy majority whip, but I don't decide what comes to committees. So I do know that committee chairs have the say of what's being heard in their committee and what's slotted in. So having a really good relationship with committee chairs, I think, is one thing I've learned is valuable here. Yes.
You know, a House term, though, is only 2 years. How do you make sure that these bills have time to marinate without just shoving them through the process?
Well, I think it's really funny because some of these have been marinating for 40 years. so I don't know if I would say that they haven't had time to marinate, right? So just this morning, I worked with my neighbor and former my senator, Jeff Irwin, on repealing a law that prohibits grad student research assistants from being able to organize. And he was here as a House member. He was my House member when it was outlawed in 2015. And so that's had a few terms to marinate, right? And so here we are with the opportunity to right that wrong. And I think many of the things that we're trying to do have had time to marinate.
Yeah, and when talking about that package, you know, I was in House Labor this morning, and it seemed like the graduate student part of it didn't get as much opposition as your bill, which talked about student athletes as well. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, I guess why that might be more controversial?
So I think that we have to remember, with collective bargaining, you can bargain on three things: compensation, working conditions, and benefits. And I think what people automatically think of is compensation, right? Student athletes do get pretty good compensation for the most part with the labor that they put in for their institutions. This would include possibly scholarships and tuition waivers, possibly assistance with housing and other expenses. Even Rep, I think it was Coons or Mueller, mentioned today the good point that they do get priority in registration for classes even. But my concern is more about working conditions. So when I've talked to people as an undergrad and graduate student at the University of Michigan who they themselves were student athletes, they've been steered in directions away from certain types of majors because of the time it would require on the student side of them being a student athlete. You know, like I said in committee, they're there to be student athletes, not athlete students.
Yeah, and I love that quote. And, you know, you just have been involved in so much legislation. Like Kyle said, I kind of want to hop around a bit and talk about your proposal to implementation that passed the House on Thursday. So for reference, we are recording this on Thursday. But yesterday, you know, on Wednesday, the House passed a pretty sweeping package of legislation implementing elements of Proposal 2. But a lot of Republicans made the argument that the bills were crafted in the dark and sort of go beyond what was required. You know, what do you have to say to that as a sponsor on the package?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I was really thrilled that Rep. Cernoglu, who was leading this package, invited me to be a participant in it. She knew, obviously, I care about democracy because of the work I'm doing on National Popular Vote. And so she reached out and said, hey, would you like to be involved? Of course I would, because I had already seen the work that was put in on this package through Secretary of State Benson's working groups. I was invited to talk with one of the working groups at a Detroit meeting in maybe February or March. And I was thrilled to be able to be there to talk about National Popular Vote, but then look around the room and they had to keep bringing in more chairs with how many people were there. There were clerks, there were democracy groups, Senator Jeremy Moss was there. At this one that I was at, Senator Camilleri was there talking about the Michigan Voting Rights Act. So there's just so much work going on to protect and advance democracy in Michigan. And I guess I don't know how I would say these were written in the dark if there were like 40 people in the room and they had to keep bringing chairs in. And that was only one of the working groups. They had another working group in May that I Zoomed into. It was all via Zoom, and there were more than 24 people on that working group. And they were talking about, how do we get the right number for precinct size? How do we make sure that we're monitoring the passing of ballots when they're absentee ballots, when they're mail-in ballots? How do we make sure that the what is the guidance the clerks really want in statute about the postage? That was my bill. It was implementing the required prepaid postage, as well as processing for signatures and signature verification for the mail-in and absentee ballots. So I just don't buy that it was done, quote unquote, in the dark, when there were literally dozens of people in multiple public meetings talking about how to do this. And we were taking a lot of feedback from the clerks themselves who would have to implement this.
I was speaking with Minority Leader Hall this week. He said there are exactly zero votes in his caucus right now for National Popular Vote. How does that set with you when you're trying to make this a bipartisan initiative?
It's not me that's making it a bipartisan initiative. This has always been a bipartisan initiative. National Popular Vote in Michigan has been introduced by Republicans many times, passed under Republican leadership. We have a dozen Republicans that signed onto a letter to the Republican caucus, including Mike Green and Dick Pasumas, which makes me wonder how like some of my colleagues' Thanksgiving dinners goes. At this point, if this allegation is true, but I don't believe it, because it's always been bipartisan, and I'm working to make sure that National Popular Vote passes in a bipartisan fashion.
Why are you passionate about it?
Well, this is the founding principle of our democracy: one person, one vote. Right? I mean, even my colleague, Rep. Bolin from the 49th District, yesterday in our House conversation about the Prop 2 implementation, said, "I believe in one person, one vote." And I'm thrilled to be the sponsor of National Popular Vote, because it really builds on that principle. Every voter in every election in every state should have a say in our president. And that is true before. That's true now. I don't know what's changed since we've had this bill introduced by Republicans before. I had to win the most popular votes in my district in order to be elected. And I believe the president should have to do the same thing. They should have to win the most popular votes in their district, which is the entire country. And it's not just me that says that. We have a huge coalition of folks, and actually more keep signing on every week. I know there's some criminal justice folks that are looking at this week. We have conservation groups, we have labor groups, and we have, of course, democracy groups and civil protection groups. So we want to make sure that every person has an equal voice in the presidential election. We want to make sure that the person who wins the most votes, the most popular votes, wins the presidency. So we want to align the Electoral College with the National Popular Vote. And we want to make sure that this helps those dozens of groups that are helping us push this over the line.
I kind of want to mess things up a bit that isn't on our agenda. But while we're talking about voting, I want to talk about the potential of an early presidential primary for Democrats that Republicans won't get the same benefits out of. You know, if I am a purple ticket splitting voter in Michigan, and we have many of those in our state, I would rather participate in a more competitive primary, which will be the Republican one next year. How is it fair for democracy to have Democrats get bigger benefits out of their presidential primary than another party?
Gosh, I really can't speak for the Michigan Republican Party and how they are going to decide what they do this year. So I would recommend just interviewing them about that.
No, and now I'm going to switch it, though. I am very interested in your interest in bringing a powwow to our state capitol and making our capitol lawn more welcoming to our indigenous community here in our state.
Thank you so much for bringing this up. This is something I've been working on with Yvonne Franzek from Rep. Whitwer's office. She is actually one of the only staffers in the whole Capitol that is a member of one of the tribes here in Michigan. She's a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. And we've been working on having the first ever powwow at the Capitol, on the Capitol lawn, on Michigan Indian Day, which is the fourth Friday in September every year. So this year will be September 22nd. And the day before, we will also be having an Anishinaabeg lobby day, because we're working on, by the end of this month, dropping a package of bills that really uplift Indigenous Michiganders. Things like changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. Things like making sure that traditional healing methods are covered by Medicaid. Things like making a state grain be manumen, which is wild rice farmed in the Great Lakes for centuries here by Indigenous Michiganders. So these are some of the things that will uplift the Anishinaabeg and Indigenous people in Michigan. I'm thrilled to be working with Yvonne and Rep. Whitwer's office on doing this for the first time. We really hope that all of Lansing shows up. I know it's a Friday, but it will be fun. We'll have wonderful vendors. We'll have wonderful dancing. And we'll really be able to appreciate the Native American and Indigenous people here in Michigan.
Of course. And, you know, kind of bringing it back to a little bit more of your legislation, you know, it's been a pretty busy few weeks for you. It seems like a lot of your bills are starting to see movement. What would you say is your number one priority at the moment?
At the moment, I would say national popular vote is my number one priority to get voted out of the House by the end of June. It's really important for us. This is a Democratic Party priority and a priority of myself, because we really want to make sure that we have this enacted and done with so that other states can join us. Right now, Alaska, a Republican-controlled state, is pushing for national popular vote in their state. So I kind of want to beat them.
Of course, and I did have a follow-up about that that I kind of want to go back to now that you brought it up again. I know that you said, you know, even if the legislation passes in Michigan, the compact won't likely get the 270 electoral votes it needs by the 2024 election. So, you know, why do you, what's the rush, I guess, why now?
Well, we could do this via ballot initiative, or we could do this with the power the U.S. Constitution gives us as legislators, right? In Article 2, Section 1, right there, it says that the state legislatures are the only ones that have the power to award our electoral college votes. So I hope that we can use our power now and make this, this is so much easier. It's, it doesn't cost as much, and it's a power we actually have.
Tell our listeners what a copay accumulator is if they don't know.
So in health insurance, you pay a deductible. Each person covered will pay a certain amount of their care before the insurance covers the rest. For our services, sometimes we pay what is called a copay. This is a part that a patient will pay out of pocket at the time of service. And right now, some health insurance companies are not counting those copays toward your annual out-of-pocket maximum or toward your deductible. And we want to make sure that this is outlawed, because there are people who have rare and specific conditions that sometimes there is only one medical treatment available, and they are not able to afford the out-of-pocket expenses, which can be thousands of dollars in copay every single month. And so sometimes patients will receive these copay assistance, cash assistance cards to help pay for those copays. And we want to make sure all those copays count toward the out-of-pocket maximum, because once you hit that in the year, then you don't have to keep paying copays. We have stories of patients who've been required to repay again those copays. So they pay with a copay assistance card that they get from maybe a charitable organization, maybe one of the pharmaceutical companies with these specialized medications. And it's just like a cash Visa card, and they use that. And the insurance company, unfortunately, isn't counting that toward their out-of-pocket maximum. So we want to make sure that all those copays count in their out-of-pocket maximums.
That can't make you very popular with the insurance industry or Blue Cross.
Oh, I talked to them immediately about this. I was happy to talk with them, the Michigan Association of Health Plans, and hear what they had to say. Right now, I'm still waiting on some information. The argument is that this will raise premiums, but we haven't seen that. We haven't seen evidence of that in any state that's done that so far, has instituted or has banned these copay accumulators. So I haven't really seen the data. So I'm not here to be popular. I'm here to do things that are popular with the Michiganders who voted us in, to do things that they want us to do. Things like make sure every vote counts. Things like make sure every copay counts. I just, that's why I'm here. Why would I go through all of this to be here if it wasn't for that?
What do you think is the likeliness that Democrats are going to leave this legislative term having made a big, serious difference in the cost of health care?
the likelihood.
Yeah.
I think that there will be some changes to the cost of healthcare here in Michigan. But I don't think that it's just the legislature that can have an impact on the cost of healthcare. There are national forces, there are national policies that are affecting the cost of healthcare here in Michigan. You will see this eventually, but I have a large policy proposal to address the cost of healthcare here as a state coming up soon. So when that happens, I'm happy to come back and talk, but that one would have a much bigger impact and has a much less likelihood of going anywhere.
The year is 2023. Why do we still have laws on the books regarding the criminalization of sodomy?
That is a really good question. It's been outlawed by the Supreme Court through the Lawrence v. Texas case, but it's still here on our books, just like so many other outdated things. And, you know, with a pro-LGBT majority finally, I think it's time to get all these old crappy laws off our books and make sure that people can do what they want in their own bedrooms with other consenting adults. I was grateful for Rep. Arbit to invite me to join that package.
What are some other old bills? I mean, not old bills, but old laws on the books that you can think of?
Well, did you know that currently in Michigan, any statute that refers to marriage talks about a husband and a wife? We need to clean up that old laws. I officiate weddings. I've been able to officiate weddings since 2011, and I have officiated many same-sex weddings. Thankfully, in Washtenaw County, where I've done most of my marriages, the marriage licenses say spouse one and spouse two, because that's what's law right now, is spouse one and spouse two can choose to get married. And I think our state's laws should match that, spouse and spouse. And thankfully, Rep. Morgan just introduced 52 bills yesterday to repeal all of those, or to modify all of the mentions of husband and wife to be spouse and spouse. So that's an example. Wow. I was happy to be the sponsor of the one that changes the marriage licenses, because like I said, I officiate weddings.
That would be a long session day.
Yeah, it was a long time introducing it. He kept saying, when are we starting? When are we starting? And so I had to be, get your butt back up here. We need to get voting on all these bills that we voted on yesterday, Wednesday.
Yeah, you know, that was a pretty hectic session day yesterday, and it seems like there's, you know, a lot more coming. I guess, what is the timeline for some of those pieces of legislation? When do you think we'll see them hit the floor?
The bills I sponsored?
Yes, and the package just updating Michigan's kind of some of the marriage laws.
Oh, that one I'm sure will not come until the fall. All 52 of those bills will not come until the fall or sometime thereafter. We'd probably have to really prep for that. It would be a great question for the speaker, the floor leader. As far as my bills that I am sponsoring, I'm pretty sure that the National Popular Vote will get a floor vote before the end of summer, or before the end of session before summer. Otherwise, I think most of the stuff I'm working on will come around in the fall. We have a lot, unless we have those beautiful session days in July and August, which I would love to come in for.
Oh, I thought you were going to give us a break. I mean, come on now.
What? You're going to have 3 weeks. Oh, get back here.
Oh, geez. Oh, Pete.
I'm just behind on my summer tan. That's all I have to say.
We got spoiled by the inactivity of the last legislature. Come on now. We got to.
Well, buckle up, Buttercup, because we got a lot of work to do.
Obviously, it sounds like it. And you're at the forefront. We appreciate you coming into MERS World Headquarters to talk about it. Representative Carrie Reingans, thank you so much again for coming into MERS World Headquarters.
Thank you.
Join us now on the podcast is the CEO of the Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences. His name is Maurice Morton. And also joining us is the school's chief academic officer, Lawrence Hood. Thank you both for joining us on the podcast.
Our pleasure. Good to be joining you.
Well, we wanted to have you on the podcast because of this amazing announcement that was made that you all are going to be hiring teachers into your district for a salary of $100,000 a year. Now, before we get into the subject, let's give our listeners a little bit of background about who you are and how long you've been around. Maurice, describe what is the Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences.
So Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences, we're a charter school in the city of Detroit, one of the state's oldest and longest running charter schools. We've been around now for going on 27 years. Right now we serve a little over 1,000 scholars, We're K through eight with, you know, an elementary and a middle school. You know, our school is unique because, you know, it's centered around the arts and sciences. So, you know, our choir has become nationally renowned, having competed on America's Got Talent, performed on the Ellen Show three times, performed at the White House for then President Obama, and also the only choir nationally who ever performed on the Disney stage at Disney World. And so they've traveled the country, they've traveled the state performing, and that's how we built our reputation as a charter school in Michigan.
And go ahead and give our listeners a little bit about your background.
Well, I am the CEO of Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences. My background is a little unique in that I'm an attorney by trade and training. I actually started out in the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office as a prosecutor over 20 years ago. And you know, during that time, I ran the major drug unit. I ran other units. I was in the homicide section. And ultimately, it was at that time that I got involved with the founding of the school, because we saw at that time that, you know, a lot of Black and brown children were being prosecuted for, you know, simple drug-related offenses in the city of Detroit. And I remember, you know, speaking to Mike Duggan at that time, who was the elected prosecutor, said, look, what can we do about this? And we looked at educational type options to try to educate, you know, away from crime and out of poverty was the key. And so I got heavily involved with the school at that time, went back to school myself, and then ultimately came in, got involved with the school as the CEO. And that was about a little over 10 years ago.
Wow. And then Lawrence Hood, let's get you in the conversation. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background and what you do as the chief academic officer.
Well, thank you so much for having us. Again, Lawrence Hood is my name. This is my 26th year in education, and that number is significant because I was one of the founding teachers here at Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences. My first year teaching was here at Detroit Academy. I stayed here for a couple of years, and I moved on to become a principal. I started as a teacher, became a principal, assistant principal, principal. Then I became executive director, vice president for national organizations supporting schools across the country, and helping them improve their academic performance. And then I would say 4 years ago, I was actually brought back to Detroit Academy by Mr. Morton to support each of our buildings, each of the principals. So I supervise our principals and lead all of our academic initiatives across the district.
One more question before we get to John. Founded in 1997 by Jim Holly, is this school. Just tell our listeners where it's located and where you draw from, where your students come from to come here.
Yeah, we're located just outside of downtown Detroit on East Jefferson. So literally about a mile from the Rensen, right up the road. Our students come from all over the city. So it's not any one particular community. 80% of our scholars are bused in. We have our own transportation services. So we're out there every morning bringing children in from the west side, southwest, east side, northern part of the city. So they're coming from all over, and primarily all over the city of Detroit.
I'm real curious to talk about this, the salary figure that you settled on, the $100,000 salary. When did you decide that was a strategy you needed to take? What was the impetus behind it? And I guess also, where does that put the academy in terms of relationship to other schools and what they pay?
Yeah, so let me start by saying this has been in the works for 2 years. We started having the conversation right after COVID. When people really, you know, when you started feeling the impact of teachers leaving education, the lack of students, college students going into education. And so the teacher shortage is real, and it's really impacting schools, not just throughout the state of Michigan, but very much so in the city of Detroit, very hard, very, you know, tough impact. And so for us, we saw that, you know, it was just a little over 5 years ago, but prior to COVID, We're just two teachers short of 100% certified. So we're around 95% certified teachers on staff. Today, we're only at 1/3 of our teachers are certified. And so, and that's true with a lot of institutions, especially charter schools and public schools, you know, traditional public schools. So we started the conversation on, you know, what can we do, you know, to get our teachers certified, to draw in certified teachers into our school. And so we've done surveys with teachers, with staff members. You know, we looked at the national data. We looked at all the studies that's come out nationally looking at, you know, teacher pay is a major factor of why teachers are leaving education. You know, you go into, you know, the AI field, IT, anything else, and you're making $100,000 or more. And so ultimately we said, look, someone's got to take that bold step. And after we figured it out financially, we said, you know what, we're ready to do this. And so we did. We said, you know, we announced the program as our best in class program, which is basically premised on one thing. We said that every child deserves to have a best in class teacher or model teacher in the classroom. That's how you're going to make a difference. You know, otherwise, you know, state of Michigan is ranked 37th nationally. And so, you know, what can we do to be better as a state and as a community when it comes to education?
How does that work with your existing teachers? I mean, are you just going to say, here, we're going to raise you up? You're going to have higher expectations. How does that work with, since you already have an existing staff?
Yeah, so I'll say the way it works is actually a process. So when we look at model teachers, we're looking at the best of the best. And so those teachers that we may have inside of our building are great teachers, but not all of them actually qualify for model teacher. So a few things, as Mr. Morgan was saying, like one is you have to have teacher certification, because again, 70% of our children, teachers are not certified. So you have to be highly qualified, meaning you have certification. Also with the criteria, you also have to have certain data points, that metrics that you've met. And also on the other side, of the last 3 years, you had to be highly effective in your evaluation rating at least 2 times of the last 3 years. So everyone sees and notices the criteria, and they know whether they qualify or not.
Do you know of any other school that is doing something like this?
Well, in our research, there is no other schools locally. And there's one that we know of nationally. It's called the Equity Project in New York. That's the only other school that we know of that's doing something like this. Now, there's some suburban school districts that may receive higher per pupil allocation, where some of their teachers may have made it to that 100,000 mark after 25, 30 years. But no, like, we are offering this 100,000 to those model teachers even after 5 years. You know, if you meet the criteria and you have that success with your scholars, then we're offering this to teachers after 5 years. And as Mr. Morton always says, where else will you find a profession that, or anywhere in education, that's providing $100,000 for teachers, you know, almost out of college, 5 years out of college, yeah, or like 26, 27 years old.
Teachers in the district currently earn anywhere between $49,000 and $72,000 based on experience. So this is a significant jump, to be sure. Are you, what kind of reaction have you all received already from this announcement, which came out in late May?
It's been nothing but positive. And, you know, it's amazing. And it's come nationally, right? I mean, we've gotten applicants out of New York, across the country, across the state. You know, people have been excited. In fact, you know, some of our partner schools have reached out and said, hey, how are you doing this? Do you mind sharing, you know, how, you know, the criteria, the metrics you're utilizing, data points, in order to identify who, you know, who these teachers are, and in your interview process, how does that look? So it's been quite exciting, you know, the impact it's having. I mean, what we've heard is, you know, this is long overdue. We've heard from teachers outside of our own school who said, hey, glad you're doing what you're doing. Hopefully my school does the same. This is long overdue in education to show that teachers are appreciated. And that's what we're hoping, that this would have an impact on not just us, but other schools, and then on education, the education field, you know, nationally, period. Because otherwise, if we don't find the solution as a country, and especially, you know, as a state, you know, there's a crisis going on, and we have to find a way to draw talent into education, people who want to continue to teach.
Can I add to that, as he was saying, our goal is not just, you know, selfishly saying we want all the teachers to hoard them here. It's really about being that disruptor and actually leading the way and saying, hey, we figured it out. How about you? And making sure that all teachers get paid what they truly should be paid in the educational space. And, you know, not saying anyone particular, but we know just this announcement alone has caused board members to question, like, other things, like other districts, to say, hey, why can't we do this? And that question, mm-hmm. that conversation is what we wanted across not just Detroit, but across the country. One of our boards to start asking questions, and we wanted us to start thinking about how we can reallocate those dollars to support our teachers in the classroom.
Obviously, it's a big increase in budget eventually when it is fully in effect. How did you step up the academy to get it ready, to get ready for that funding wise?
It was 2 years in the works. I mean, we're fortunate. I think we have the best CFO in the country, and Mr. Walt Jones. And so we started looking at our numbers, and our average pay with our district was $60,000. So we knew the gap was $40,000. And under this program, we said during the first year, this is a 4-year program, you know, before we get 100% of our staff there, we knew, okay, we want to go with possibly 25% of our staff, or about 18 staff members this first year. So we knew that gap was around $800,000. Charter schools for the first time this past year was eligible for some millage money. So we looked at that. We also looked at the state per pupil increase. It was a matter of reallocating some existing funds and new funds and saying, what's our priority? And we had to make the tough, you know, the tough decision, which was, you know, hey, but the right decision, which is, hey, the money should be going to those who are on the front lines, the teachers, right? And so looking at how we're structured, do we have a need for all of our admin assistants? Do we have a need for all these other, you know, ancillary positions, and what impact would we have if we put the money directly into the teachers' pockets? And we're hoping that we'll see long-term that we'll have a great impact, particularly with scholar achievement.
This means that you're taking out the trash then. Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't use the word trash, but we're working out. We're getting leaner and meaner is what we're doing.
Yeah, my question was kind of along the same lines as far as what this means as far as the number of applicants. And maybe you can talk to this, Lawrence, as far as what you used to be getting in terms of applicants, as far as numbers, and what you're getting now as far as applicants.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, we would have rolled this out in January. Let me start there. Like, ideally, like, the timing is not exactly where we wanted it to be. Just because we're still working things out. So right now, again, rolling out nationally, we have a lot of people who are thinking about this. I don't know our exact numbers of what we, in terms of applicants more recently, but I can tell you they were very sparing applicants, where we probably would get, we're looking like in August, September, still trying to fill positions. We're now very confident that our positions, all of our positions will be filled by the beginning of August, versus we're looking later on, and we're actually closing out our best in class applicants by July 1st. So in terms of numbers, I don't know our exact numbers off the top of my head, but I think our biggest thing is about quality though right now.
Yeah.
Of applicants, because before, you know, not saying the trash, but you may have someone who comes from different fields of life saying, hey, I could just be a teacher. So it might be someone who worked in, they was an engineer yesterday, and today they just said they wanted to be a teacher. They just applied. Or some people were applying from the unemployment office, and this is a real thing. Because they had to do so many applicants, they were just making applications to teach. And those were like some of the pool of candidates that we had to pull from. Now, when you talk about the quality of candidates, we are able to be very selective, even in our process. Well, we know right off the top of my head, like we have over 30 applicants that are highly qualified, ready to go just for this best in class with certifications, teacher certification. That's unheard of right now in this day and time, especially for a relatively small district, you know, with 1,000 children.
And just to be clear here too, this program, $100,000, the folks who come in, they just don't get $100,000 right off the bat, right? This is kind of phased in. Is that right, Maurice?
No, they get $100,000.
If you right meet off the bat, period, wow.
Right off the bat. That's wow. It's if you meet the criteria, you know, so 5 years experience, you're certified, and you're highly effective, and you apply today, and you go through the interview process, and you're recommended, you start at $100,000.
You do got to sign a 3-year contract.
With a 3-year contract. Yeah, okay, right. With a 3-year contract.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm curious, and I'm probably gonna get some of our subscribers mad at me with this question, but obviously charter schools have different advantages and different disadvantages from traditional public schools. There's 500 plus traditional public school districts in the state of Michigan. Based on what you've experienced setting this program up and getting ready, do you think a regular old school district could implement the same kind of approach?
Yes.
Find resources within their budget and do it?
Absolutely. It's just a matter of looking at the priorities, right? As we indicated, remember, this is the $100,000 is going towards model teachers. Those are the best of the best. Right. So, you know, it's not every teacher. And by saying model teachers, we're given a pathway for those who aren't quite there yet. Like, look, if you reach this point of being highly effective, certified, then you can get there. But I, you know, we do think other districts can do the same. It's just a matter of looking at their dollars and allocating it appropriately. It wasn't, you know, we received the same state aid funding. You know, I understand they're larger. Some of these other districts, they have additional dollars that charter schools don't get. And so we're hoping that other districts will kind of look long and hard at their current funding and how they can allocate dollars to do the same.
If they have the will, they can find the way.
Yeah.
I just want to add to it. I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for this next comment, but I'm excited to say that since our announcement, one of our local districts has announced that their traditional public school district, they're actually giving an additional $20,000 increase to their model teachers now. So we're excited about that, you know, for the district, but that also shows that it can be done.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for laying this out here. We're running out of time here, but thank you much, Maurice Morton, the CEO of the Detroit Academy of Arts and Sciences, and also the Chief Academic Officer, Lawrence Hood. Thank you very much for being on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all our guests, Adam Zemke, Carrie Reingens, Maurice Morton, Lawrence Hood. Also, thanks to our sponsor, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. For the boss, John Roering, Samantha Schreiber, and Danielle James, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.